This brings us to our guest, Lenny Powell. And I am so excited to be able to talk about these cases. And we're going to talk about them, hopefully in a way in which we're all, by the end of this, enlightened as to what's been going on in the area of law and Native American rights. Good morning, Lenny Powell.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I want to dive in first and just talk about your work that you've been doing over many years. You are the expert, and I am excited about the constitutionality of some of these cases that we've discussed on our program over the years, especially dealing with the Indian child welfare cases, the initial case and then the one that's more recently decided. And so there's also a major case regarding water rights. So first, let's talk about your background. How did you get involved in these types of cases?
So I'm Native American myself. My tribe is the Hopland Band of Pomo Indians, located in Northern California. And I'm a former leader of my tribe. I served on our tribal council from 2010 to 2013 before I went to law school. Now in private practice, I spent a lot of my time representing tribes with the law firm Jenner and Block. My practice areas are sort of a crossover of appellate and Supreme Court work and the law that governs the relationship between the United States and Indian tribes and sort of sets the separation of authority between the United States state governments and tribal governments within Indian country. So I've worked on the Indian child welfare case you mentioned, Holland v. Brackeen, this past year. I worked on the McGurkey, Oklahoma case that was about whether the Creek Reservation in eastern Oklahoma persists. And in this Arizona v. Navajo Nation case, I wrote an amicus brief on behalf of a group of historians who offered sort of a deep dive into the history that was relevant to that case.
Wow. Which one would you like to begin with?
Well, perhaps Brackeen, because that was really a core case about the importance of federal Indian law more generally and sort of why this body of law exists and how it came to be.
Now, first, let's say the historic representation of Holland as Secretary of the Interior.
I'm sorry, could you say that one more time?
Yes, we're let's even is history being made that we have the Secretary of the Interior being a Native American?
Oh, yes, absolutely. A massive historical moment to finally have a Native American and a Native American woman be at the top of the department that is primarily charged with executing the United States trust obligations to Indian tribes.
And so when we're talking about the Brackeen case, that might have been very interesting that you're suing her, well, as Secretary of the Interior, regarding this issue around Indian child welfare. Tell us something that I think that many of us have heard but don't really understand, why the Native American history from the boarding schools going forward is such an important part of this case.
Yeah. At a high level, I'll say, the relationship between Indian tribes and the United States is a complicated one. The United States is, under the law, the trustee for Indian tribes. It has responsibilities to, oversee the care of Indian lands and uphold tribal self-government. But historically, the United States has often been the primary, attacker of tribal rights, the very rights it's supposed to uphold. And the Indian boarding schools are a good example of that. In the late 1800s, the federal government, as part of its policy of assimilation, forcibly removed Indian children from their homes, took them hundreds of miles away, and placed them into boarding schools where, the goal was, to use the saying of the man who developed the policy, to kill the Indian and save the man. The Native children were not allowed to speak their own language. They weren't allowed to have, you know, long hair. They had to wear, you know, clothing that was foreign to them. It was a very oppressive and traumatic experience for them. In addition, of course, to being, you know, isolated by themselves. There were, you know, other Native children. They were together, but otherwise they were completely disconnected from their tribal communities.
And so what is that connection? Many of people don't understand why that there's a protection around Native children and adoption by people who are non-Native. And it was, some people have called it racism, that non-Native people are not seen as eligible in the same line as Native people in adopting a Native child. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think the place to start that conversation is probably the 1950s and the 1960s. The boarding school period did come more or less to an end, but the United States sought to transfer its responsibilities for the care of Indian children to state governments. And once state governments accepted that responsibility, their policies were directed toward the removal of Indian children, not into boarding schools now, but into non-Indian homes, for at least two reasons. One was that it saved the state money to place Indian children in non-Indian homes. And the second was that there started to be an escalating desire among at least some non-Indian adults to adopt Indian children. And states wanted to satisfy that demand. And Congress finally in the 1970s turned toward a policy of tribal self-determination instead of assimilation of Native peoples and termination of tribal governments. And when Congress turned to the self-determination era, one of the primary things it studied was this placement of Native children into non-Indian homes. And Congress studied the issue for years. It reached extensive findings and it found that the states were removing Indian children completely without cause, that the social workers who would come in and remove the children really had no grounds, no competency in assessing Indian home life, and would assert bases for removal that just were unjustified under any conceivable standard. And so Congress, with overwhelming bipartisan support, adopted ICWA in 1978 to address that challenge. And one of the things that ICWA does is when you have a proceeding in state court for the placement of an Indian child in an Indian in a foster care placement or up for adoption, ICWA sets a series of placement preferences for adoption. They are one, with a member of the child's family, two, a member of the child's tribe, or three, a member of any other Indian tribe, but a state court has grounds to depart from those list of preferences for good cause shown, and they only apply when you actually have a placement at hand. There's no obligation on behalf of the party seeking, for instance, to adopt a child to go out and find, or the state for that matter, no obligation to go out and find families that meet these preferences. If no one comes up that falls within the groups, they don't, that the preferences just simply don't apply. I think this gets at, your question gets at the equal protection argument some people have made against ICWA. They tend to be focused on those placement preferences. And I think there are two important things to understand when you're thinking about equal protection in this context. The first is that the Supreme Court has squarely held correctly that laws that classify based on tribal status are not race-based laws. They are laws that are based in the political relationship that's really twofold. One, the political relationship between the tribal government and the federal government, and two, the political relationship that is citizenship, the individual person's citizenship in the tribal government. And that actually can include persons who are not racially Native American, a high-profile example of this, for instance, is that there was a group of Cherokee citizens known as the Cherokee Freedmen, who are the descendants of former slaves of the Cherokee Nation. Until the Civil War, the Cherokee Nation had held slaves. And some of those Cherokee freedmen today have no, you know, racial Cherokee ancestry, but they are tribal citizens for purposes of things like ICWA. So in that sense, this law is not even drawing racial lines to start with. But then when you look at those placement preferences that ICWA has, you know, the first one, for instance, placement with a member of the Indian child's family, that applies regardless of whether the family member is Native American or not Native American. So, for instance, there's no Native American ancestry on my mother's side, but I had had to go through a placement preference when I was a child. You know, the family members on my non-Native mother's side would have had the same preferences under this law that the Native family members on my father's side would have.
And when we talk about ICWA, we're saying the Indian Child Welfare Act. And so we have these cases, one in which we had a child who was placed, and these are two Supreme Court cases, and child rights, the father's right to the child, and the father was Native. They said those rights were broken through a text message. So, and the child was, the dispute around the placement for the child. And I know this can be very complicated, and I'm trying to get to the case we have now, but I'm just giving and allowing you to go into deeper weeds for this. The idea that, as you said before, it is a complex area, the relationship between so many of the different indigenous tribes, those recognized, those not recognized, falling under the Department of the Interior. And there's so many, every aspect of human life you have within these controversies. And of course, adoption being one of them. And that's been probably a lightning rod of an issue of controversy, because those cases have gone to the Supreme Court. Give us very quickly a summary of the most recent Indian child welfare case.
Yeah, so the Holland v. Brackeen case that I helped litigate, that was decided this past summer, it was a broad challenge to the law in total. It did not actually arise out of any one specific child welfare proceeding. It was instead an attempt to say that just the law really had no valid core application and should be struck down in its entirety. And it was a suit by persons who claimed to want to adopt Indian children against federal officials, and several tribal governments who were my clients also intervened to help defend the law. They said that the law was outside of Congress's power to enact, because the federal government is a government of limited powers. You have to sort of identify a specific provision or provisions or other sources of authority based on the Constitution in order for Congress to enact a law. And their other principal challenge was the equal protection challenge that I referenced. What the Supreme Court ended up doing this summer is it rejected the challenges. On Article I grounds, the Supreme Court recognized that it's long held that Congress and the federal government more generally has plenary power in this area of the law. It's grounded in things like the Indian Commerce Clause, the Indian Treaty Clause, and the trust relationship between Native American tribes and the United States, and that Congress from the beginning has legislated in all sorts of areas, not just trade, but criminal law, tax law, health care, et cetera. And that if Congress can legislate in all those areas, it certainly can legislate with respect to family law as well. And we did not actually get a ruling on the merits of the equal protection challenge there. The Supreme Court found that the fact that the parties had tried to bring this case served as an abstract challenge to the whole law rather than as a challenge arising in a particular adoption proceeding, meant that they lacked standing to bring the case. It's a sort of a technical legal concept, but it basically means you need to be able to show you've got a concrete injury that will be directly resolved by the case before the court, and they fail to show that there.
Excellent. And so one other case that we can get to right now, I think is so important because it deals with water, something that we all need in order to survive, something that our crops need in order for us to eat. So tell us about this water claims case.
Yes. So Arizona v. Navajo Nation, don't let the case caption confuse you. It was really a dispute between the United States and the Navajo Nation, not between the Arizona Nation, or sorry, between the state of Arizona and the United States. It is a great illustration of the concept I mentioned at the front about the fact that the United States is sometimes a tribal ally, sometimes a tribal foe. At the same time that the United States was fighting to defend ICWA alongside tribal governments and alongside the Navajo Nation, the United States was resisting the Navajo Nation's attempt to get its water rights. But the case was an effort by the Navajo Nation to force the United States to identify the sources of the nation's water rights and make a plan to meet those rights. By way of background, when the United States set aside an Indian reservation, implicitly sets aside enough water to meet the purposes of that reservation. These water rights are held by the United States in trust for the government, for the tribe whose reservation has been set aside. And in the case of the Navajo, those water rights are especially important because water was a central issue when the Navajos now permanent homeland was established. They had been forced over a series of long walks, upwards of 53 by some counts, forcibly by the military away from their homeland to a place called Bosque Redondo. And it was a terrible tragedy. It's akin to the Trail of Tears. People were forced at gunpoint. Many died on the walk of the summit. It was up to 450 miles to this Bosque Redondo area. Some were shot if they were sick or otherwise unable to make the journey. And then when they got to Bosque Redondo, it was an unlivable area in significant part due to lack of water. And when the United States finally recognized that the situation was unsustainable, and they entered into treaty negotiations with the Navajo Nation. The Navajo were insistent that they be returned to their original homeland, and they cited as one of their primary reasons for the move as the water resources that had been available in their homeland but that were not available at Bosque Redondo. And eventually the United States did relent and entered into the 1868 Navajo Treaty that promised them a permanent homeland. But despite those promises today, the water needs on the Navajo Nation are very significant. For instance, the average American household uses around 100 gallons of water per day. On the Navajo Nation, it's closer to an average of 7 gallons per day. And some Navajo citizens have to travel many miles to get to potable water. Everyone agrees that the Navajo Nation has a lot of water rights, again, that are held by the United States for the Navajo, that the Navajo is not able to access, and the Navajo really need to, one of their most pressing concerns is the need to address that situation, and they've been trying for decades to address it, really. And then the United States has done some things, but not nearly enough. And so this suit was about trying to get the United States to live up to those promises that it had made in 1868.
And what was the outcome of the suit? I hear it's quite successful.
The outcome, unfortunately, was a loss for the Navajo Nation. The Supreme Court ended up taking a very strict approach to the language of the treaty. It held that in a vote of 5-4, it held that the treaty needed to have very precise language imposing this duty on the United States to develop a plan to meet the water needs. And the Supreme Court just basically said, we don't see words that say exactly that, so we're not going to force the United States to do these actions.
And so the successful suit you had was one regarding the Muskogee?
Yes. McGirt was the case from 2020. That was about the creek, Muskogee Creek Reservation in eastern Oklahoma. That case was about whether the reservation persists. When a reservation is set aside, it continues to endure so long as Congress does not act to disestablish it. And in 1906, with Oklahoma statehood, Oklahoma began to act like the Muskogee Creek Reservation, as well as a number of other reservations in eastern Oklahoma, no longer existed, even though there was no clear moment where Congress had stripped the reservations away. And essentially, for over 100 years, Oklahoma had succeeded in more or less denying, for practical purposes, the continued existence of the reservations. You know, the issue was not completely closed, and there were ways in which the federal government was continuing to recognize that those lands had special status, but in many ways, the promises of reservations were not being fulfilled. And in 2020, the issue went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, in an opinion by Justice Gorsuch, look, our opinions are very clear. Congress has to unequivocally terminate a reservation. Otherwise, it continues to exist. And that was never done. There was no termination of the reservation in the case of the Creek Nation. So their reservation persists. And since that decision was issued, other lower courts have recognized that its logic applies to many other Oklahoma reservations. And today, more or less, about half the state of Oklahoma is recognized as Indian country as a result.
And with that political and economic a voice regarding that decision, or is that the next step?
So
will that give Native people a voice in Oklahoma that's beyond what they're able to exercise now?
Yes. So reservation status is important because the special rules that apply to tribes and to individual Native Americans, they more or less don't get triggered unless and until you're in Indian country, which can be an Indian reservation, it can be certain individual Indian allotments, but that's sort of often the first question when you are dealing with a tribal issue is, are you in the special lands that have been set aside where the body of federal Indian law applies? And it's hard for a tribe to really exercise authority until it can show that its reservation or other form of Indian country exists. So the existence of these reservations now allows the Creek Nation, the Cherokee Nation, et cetera, to exercise tribal self-governance with much less uncertainty about where those boundaries lie.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Lenny Powell, an expert, as you can hear, on indigenous law in the United States. He has had issues before the U.S. Supreme Court, briefed these cases. Have you actually argued before the U.S. Supreme Court?
I have not.
Is that the next step?
Maybe someday. By some counts, it's been over 20 years since any Native American person actually argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. Though there are many talented non-Native advocates who, you know, are experts in these issues and have been arguing these cases, and they deserve a huge amount of credit for helping win these important tribal victories.
Well, I think that's excellent on their behalf, but I also think there's the idea of your voice before the court is something we're all going to be waiting for. Thank you so much for joining us, Lenny Powell. In this season, how would you like to leave us? How do you see this season, this era, this time? Some people have said Judith LeBlanc, who's been on our program before, of Native Organizers Alliance, has said this is a special season for Indigenous and Native American rights, a special season of advocacy. How do you see this season?
So that's an excellent question. I think it's a great time to reflect on our history. I think the more that people understand how we got where we are, the better they'll understand why these fights over tribal rights are so important, and how many injustices there still are that need to be rectified.